It's just not possible to gain that much in value that quickly with declining revenue.
And that's when I really had the epiphany that investing was not about stocks and bonds. Investing is about innovation.
The belief is if there's a new piece of information, that it will be instantly incorporated into the price of the stock or the bond or whatever. But that's not how people change their minds.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ed Gotham, and welcome to Opto Sessions, where we interview the top investors from around the world, uncovering their secrets to success. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming back Jay Jacobs, who is currently the US Head of Thematics and Active Equity ETFs at BlackRock. Here, one of Jay's main priorities is leading on the research and development of the Megatrend suite of active and index-based thematic ETFs. Previously, Jay was Senior Vice President and Head of Research and Development at GlobalX ETFs, a leader in the thematic ETF space. In this interview, we discuss the Great Acceleration, which covers three trends poised for exponential growth: industrial renaissance, the power of the purse, and post-COVID medical innovation. Enjoy. Hi, Jay. Great to have you on the show again. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me back, Ed.
Where are you calling from today? Because you've moved across to BlackRock now.
I am. I'm based in BlackRock's headquarters in Midtown Manhattan today.
Oh, nice. I think it's pretty sunny there at the moment. Is that right?
This is the best time of year to be in New York. It's 70s. It's not too humid. People are back out and about. So it's a great time in New York City.
And have you lived in New York quite a long time?
I've been in New York my entire career. I spent my entire career in New York in the ETF industry. So I started at the New York Stock Exchange in the ETF listings group. I was at a firm called GlobalX for many years, helping build a startup ETF issuer into a mid-sized asset manager. And then most recently joined BlackRock. And all of that has been based in New York City.
Brilliant. Well, congratulations on your new role. Sounds a pretty exciting place to be. And yet you've just recently created a new white paper on the Great Acceleration, some interesting themes that are playing out at the moment, that basically these areas that experienced permanent change during the pandemic, and that you and BlackRock believe are poised for exponential growth going forward. So I thought it'd be great to just go through those one by one. Should we start with the industrial renaissance?
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you just possibly give us a sort of an overview of what this sort of encompasses?
Yeah, sure. And maybe I'll just take a quick step back and talk about the Great Acceleration paper. So we published this in April. Really bringing together several different groups across BlackRock's investment platform. So the Megatrends team within the ETF, the iShares ETF group, within BlackRock Systematic Equities, within our Fundamental Equities group, bringing together both active portfolio managers and in the index-based side of the business to really think through this really unique situation that we're in right now, the end of the pandemic or the tail end of the pandemic, and an economy that is trying to find its footing, and suddenly realizing that a lot has happened in the last 2.5 years. Some things have been, very painful for the global economy and society, but there's also these areas of hope and optimism and areas of potential growth. And the idea behind this paper is really trying to understand, what were those permanent changes that have occurred over the last 2.5 years? And what are those opportunities that are starting to emerge from those changes? So we've highlighted three different areas, three different kind of drivers of progress, if you will, in this Great Acceleration paper that we're very excited about for kind of near-term catalysts that are starting to accelerate their trajectory. So the first of which is industrial renaissance, but we also have what we're calling the power of the purse, which is the rising consumer. And we also have the upshot of post-COVID medicine, which is really what are the transformational changes happening in the healthcare space as well. So I'll dive into the industrial renaissance piece first. Should be no secret to anybody listening to this podcast, we have very difficult supply chain issues in the economy right now. And what I think is fascinating about this is that, in many ways, digitalization was kind of one of the heroes of the pandemic. We were all able to switch to cloud services and all able to, log in remotely to our companies and be able to chat on video chat and really kind of, facilitate a lot of our jobs. still working completely remotely through digitalization. But what's happening now is that underinvestment that's happened, you know, really for years, if not decades, in the physical side of our economy is now starting to emerge as being problematic. So we have supply chain disruptions around the world. You know, we're having difficulty getting certain goods, you know, transported from different continents over to the United States. What is the impact of that? And who are really set up to be the winners from the supply chain disruption? The first one is really looking at infrastructure. We believe that there's going to be more manufacturing and, frankly, more movement of goods and people around the United States to respond to the supply chain issues. And that's going to be very beneficial for our domestic infrastructure here. The second is looking at robotics and automation. If we're going to be building more in the United States, if we're going to do more manufacturing locally, how do we do so in a way that keeps costs down? And that's going to be really implementing as much robotics and automation as possible. And then finally, how do we address other areas where there's frictions in the economy? Even if we have good infrastructure, even if we, you know, are able to elevate our manufacturing in the US, still transporting stuff around the country is proving to be difficult. We have a huge shortage of truck drivers. We have busy, clogged roads. We have roads that are damaged. How can we use things like electric and autonomous vehicles to improve the transportation space as well, ease some of the burdens of trucker shortages? So those are the three areas that we're really most excited about when it comes to the industrial renaissance: infrastructure, robotics and automation, and electric and autonomous vehicles.
And so if we just take robotics initially, what industries do you think are going to see the largest sort of growth from robotics in response to what's been happening?
I would say there's a near-term impact and there's a long-term impact. So near-term, the major focus is on industrial automation. So that's using robots in manufacturing. That's using robots in logistics. That's frankly where robots are being used most prominently today. And we just see a lot more growth and a lot more demand in robots in those spaces. So last year, 2021, was actually one of the highest growth years for robots in the United States to begin with. You saw a lot of manufacturing companies thinking about, you know, how do we use more robots in producing a car or producing a semiconductor or consumer electronic good? How do we use more robots on our factory floors to move things around automatically? Or how do we use it in a distribution warehouse to move things around and require less human labor? So that's really kind of the near term where a lot of robotics R&D has been focused on the last few years, where a lot of sales is happening, where a lot of robots are going to be implemented in that manufacturing and logistics space. Now, if we zoom ahead, you know, that's when we see robots really getting into, you know, more of the Jetson style, you know, futuristic contributions to our society. That's where we could see robots in our houses. That's where we could see robots in hospitals, in hotels, serving us, a meal at a restaurant. That's still likely several years off before we see that really being economical, but there's a lot of R&D happening in that space too. But right now, where you see the best economics in robots is being used in manufacturing and logistics.
And so this is Elon Musk, didn't he announce that he's trying to do a Tesla sort of robot recently? These are the sort of things like the helpers around the home and things like this.
You know, there's been a lot of work on this over several decades. You know, everyone has this fantasy of kind of a general robot that can be our butler and do everything we want for us. The reality is right now, robots are very good at specialized tasks. You know, so you teach a robot to do basically one thing. It can do it quickly. It can do it accurately. Right now, for example, you know, if you were to go to a distribution warehouse, there's several tasks that have to happen to get, you know, let's say you buy a tennis racket online. You know, there's a lot that has to happen to get that tennis racket, you know, sent from the manufacturer, loaded off the truck, put in the distribution warehouse, put on a shelf, taken off that shelf, packaged in a box, and ultimately sent to you so you get that tennis racket. Right now, a lot of that is still done by humans. Really, the thing that robots are doing in that distribution warehouse is moving around the shelving, the storage, bringing, you know, that racket to the human to take off the shelf and to put it, you know, in a box that can be shipped off. But what you're seeing is across that distribution chain is how do we automate more and more of those systems? And so, you know, one of the areas where we see a lot of growth is in robots that can simply take something off a shelf and put it in a box.
Yeah.
It sounds really simple, but that's actually a very challenging problem for a robot. Where do you pick something up? Can it anticipate how heavy it'll be? What type of suction it needs to be able to pick up that object and drop it off? What happens if it tries to pick up a tennis racket, and it's instead of going for the handle where it can get a better grip, it goes for the stringing where maybe it can't hold on. So there's a lot of artificial intelligence and different types of what we call end arm tooling, really kind of the things that can grip on a robot to be able to pick up a diverse array of products and put it in a box. But that's where we're seeing a ton of innovation. And frankly, we've reached the point where that stage of distribution is getting better and better to the point where they can move over some of those tasks to robots. So maybe it's not the most exciting, robot butler that's going to serve a hamburger on a plate to you as soon as you order it, but it will facilitate greater efficiencies in distribution and logistics, which ultimately will translate into getting things cheaper and getting things faster when you order them online.
Yep. And I've seen some incredible videos from a company, might have heard of it, Ocado in the UK. It's a supermarket chain, but a lot of their sort of packing for delivery of goods to your home is all done by sort of mini robots that are picking up stuff, which is pretty incredible. And I imagine, like you're saying, this is going to happen everywhere now. So that sort of helps with the infrastructure as well, assume like the warehousing and stuff like this. And then if we talk about autonomous vehicles, electric vehicles, when do you think is the first step in those sort of things helping with logistics, shipping, et cetera?
Well, we're seeing a lot of advancements there and we're seeing, kind of a several pronged approach. One is in robo-taxis. If you go to San Francisco, you really can't go more than 5 minutes or 10 minutes without seeing, these autonomous vehicles driving around the city, mapping the city, trying to understand different situations and develop that artificial intelligence to be able to navigate city streets. Where are we today with that? There's increasing amounts of trials of truly autonomous robo-taxis happening around the country. This is not widespread yet. This isn't, going to be your next ride from the airport, but we are starting to see the needle move with more trials. And if they're successful, specifically within designated areas, then we could start to see it being expanded further and further. So I think one of the misconceptions around autonomous vehicles is that we're just going to flip a switch and a car is going to be fully autonomous and be able to go anywhere and everywhere at any time. The reality is it's much easier if you kind of parse out different areas, different geolocations, and make them available to autonomous vehicles. So if you have hundreds of autonomous vehicles driving around San Francisco every single day, mapping the city, understanding every little nook and cranny of the streets, it's obviously going to be much easier for a car then to drive autonomously through San Francisco than, the desert in New Mexico, where there hasn't been as much mapping. So what we see is kind of a phased approach in autonomous vehicles, where there's going to be certain areas that have been, appropriately mapped, where there's a regulatory support for them so that, the local city or state is comfortable with autonomous vehicles operating there. And maybe even completely designated lanes that autonomous vehicles drive in that are, more protected, or at least, pedestrians or other cars know that this is where autonomous vehicles are going to be. But if you can start to kind of segment where autonomous vehicles can operate, then you can kind of ease that transition into autonomous vehicles. So we've seen that start with robo-taxis. I think autonomous trucking is going to be a fascinating area. There's huge economic benefits to it. There's been a trucking shortage in terms of the number of truckers. Trucking costs have gone up. You see massive turnover in the trucking space each year in terms of, basically the entire trucking workforce has to be replaced almost every year given the high turnover there. So this is an area where autonomous vehicles could have incredible impact. Again, reducing shipping times, reducing costs, maybe even better emissions control if you can be kind of more thoughtful about autonomous vehicles, or of course transition to electric vehicles. And the good part of that is that a lot of trucking happens on pretty defined and simple to navigate routes. So as difficult as San Francisco might be to navigate, driving down Highway 5 in California is pretty much a straight shot. So that in theory should be much easier to get autonomous trucks comfortable with.
And you see a future where basically car ownership becomes obsolete as autonomous, summonable cars sort of become mainstream?
I would say that's kind of the distant future. If autonomous vehicles really get to that state of they can take us anywhere at any time, no questions asked, then yes, then it really does kind of challenge the idea of car ownership. but that's going to be a ways away. You know, we're still working through, you know, the various levels of autonomy. Right now, we're kind of in level 3 out of 5, I would say, in terms of kind of the capabilities of autonomous vehicles. So it's going to be, you know, probably several years until we get to that point where you don't necessarily need a car around, because you can just order up any car you want at any time and it can take you where you want to go.
And coming back to something you mentioned earlier, which is AI, the software behind all of this, which is so important to it, its success. There's been a lot of stories about how big, you know, the forecasts are for AI. And what's your thoughts and feelings on the potential of the, that as a sort of a sector, and what needs to happen for us to sort of get there?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, so AI could be an incredible boom for productivity, but AI really expresses itself in a lot of different ways. You know, one form of AI is autonomous vehicles. So, you know, you could think about how much productivity we could get out of having an autonomous vehicle. You know, I don't know how much time you spend driving each week or how much time people spend commuting. I would probably save a few hours a week for sure if I could have an autonomous vehicle take me from point A to point B. And that means if I'm not driving, then I'm either probably consuming something or working. There's really kind of not that many states you can be in. And so if I had a few more hours, I'm, you know, maybe shopping online, maybe I'm watching an online video, or I'm responding to emails. So that could be a huge boon for the economy that's really kind of indirectly related to enhancements in AI. But it goes much further than that. I mean, we could see AI being used in our jobs, robotics process automation, where simply you look at some of the more repetitive tasks that you do every day and automate them. And that frees up more time to work on the more creative, you know, more interesting tasks. This is an area that I think has incredible opportunity that we've only really skimmed the surface. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of different expressions of AI, you know, at home, at work, that I think will be very, very supportive of GDP growth going forward. But it's very difficult to say because AI is really a tool that we can apply to so many different parts of the economy. It's difficult to, you know, kind of forecast exactly how powerful that'll be.
But it's very clear from what you've been talking about that this industrial renaissance could increase productivity massively if it plays out. And how do you get an exposure to sort of this theme?
Yeah, so we look at it from kind of the individual ETF perspective, getting exposure to each of those themes that we mentioned. So we have an infrastructure ETF, IFRA, which is looking at, you know, US-based infrastructure assets as well as infrastructure enablers, kind of the companies that are helping to rebuild and supply infrastructure projects around the United States. We think that's particularly relevant. Just in the last year, we had, you know, the passage of the Infrastructure Investments and Jobs Act by the Biden administration, which is bringing $1.2 trillion to invest in infrastructure in the United States. This will take years to be spent, years to be put into, you know, action. You don't build a bridge overnight, but this will be a huge benefit for the state of U.S. infrastructure and making kind of the necessary improvements needed for alleviating some of these supply chain issues. So that's our IFRA ETF. You know, on the robotics and automation side, we have Urbo IRBO, which looks at various different segments within manufacturers of robots, developers of artificial intelligence technology, the hardware that goes into artificial intelligence. So really looking at that entire ecosystem around robotics and automation, we think that's going to be a big beneficiary for the reasons that we've been describing around the growth of AI, and in particular in manufacturing and logistics. And then finally, our ETF, iDrive, IDRV, is an ETF that gives exposure to the electric and autonomous vehicle space, looking at, you know, not only the car manufacturers that are building electric and autonomous vehicles, but the companies that are putting in the parts, supplying those cars, going all the way upstream to battery producers and the materials that go into batteries, as well as the developers of AI software and hardware. So each of these funds is really looking at the entire ecosystem behind these themes. It's not one company or one segment. It's really several segments that we see benefiting from the rise of these powerful megatrends.
Very exciting. And yeah, it would be really interesting to see how that plays out over the years to come.
We hope you're enjoying the episode. For interviews like this every Thursday, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, make sure you give us a star rating and leave guest suggestions along with any other feedback in the review section. Now, back to the show.
Let's move on to the next one, which is Power the Purse, which I believe focus on the blockchain and sustainable food. Millennials and emerging market consumers are now the drivers of consumption globally. Is that right? Is that what we're focusing on here?
We are, you know, kind of a strange aspect of the pandemic, I think, is kind of what it did to our sense of time. You know, 2.5 years passed, and you know, as much as it felt like maybe life stood still, and maybe it's to some extent kind of the economy stood still, the reality is that several demographic trends that have been underway for several decades continue to progress. So the millennial generation in the United States, it's the largest generation by number of people. It's set up to inherit trillions of dollars from the baby boomers to become a major piece of the U.S. workforce going forward. They got older. Millennials, the oldest millennials, are now over 40 years old and are huge contributors to consumption and to the workforce in the United States. That didn't stop, even despite the pandemic. Similarly, if you look at emerging markets, we've had a huge increase in consumption there, with hundreds of millions of people brought into the middle class in emerging markets just over the last decade. And that's expected to continue over the next several decades as well. So we've had a major change in some of the biggest consumption forces around the world over the last 2.5 years and beyond. So the big question is, now that we have the rise of millennials and we have the rise of this emerging market consumer, what are the impacts of that? How do they spend money differently? Where do they spend their money? What are their preferences when they evaluate a product? What do they care about? What do they not care about? Because these consumers are very different from the baby boomers and the Gen Xers, or maybe there's really no precedent for them, like the emerging market consumer. So there's two areas that we believe really stand to benefit from the rise of these new consumers. The first is blockchain technology, and the second is in sustainable food. So in blockchain technology, it's looking at how millennials really interact with finances. A lot of millennials have a preference for decentralized finance, for looking at kind of alternative sources of investing, of funding, of how they kind of treat their assets. And frankly, a lot of emerging market investors have been unbanked. They're not investors yet because they haven't been able to get financial services extended to them because, you know, kind of traditional financial systems, frankly, probably didn't see a ton of value in emerging market consumers. Blockchain technologies really address that. You know, decentralized finance is bringing finance to hundreds of millions of people around the world. We're seeing blockchain that can be used in areas beyond finance as well, in terms of securing supply chains, back to our supply chain theme, smart contracts, all these really kind of exciting areas around the ecosystem of blockchain. But we think the millennial consumer and the emerging market consumer are really uniquely excited about blockchain technologies going forward. And then the other side of that is sustainable food. Sustainable food is really, in my mind, a supply and demand issue. On the supply side, we're not getting more land. In fact, you know, the land that we use to grow crops or to grow or to raise livestock is shrinking. We have more droughts, we have more floods, we have more wildfires. That's impacting a significant amount of acreage each year, which is reducing the amount of supply that we have to grow crops and to raise livestock. On the demand side, though, we have a population that's growing. We're going to go from about 8 billion people to 10 billion people by 2060. And we have hundreds of millions of people in the emerging markets that are going to be middle-class consumers, moving from, you know, very basic food groups to more complex food groups like dairy and meat. And dairy and meat are very inefficient from a food systems perspective. So if you see more people consuming more complex foods that are less efficient, and on the supply side, we basically have static or declining amounts of land that we can use to meet that demand, we believe that food insecurity is going to be a real challenge going forward. Frankly, we're seeing that play out in real time with some of the conflict in Russia and Ukraine, which is bringing a lot of food supply offline. We're seeing how impactful you know, supply chain challenges can be in just this segment of food. So how do we think about getting enhanced crop yields? How do we use technology to grow food more effectively? Can we grow food inside? Can we grow food using hydroponics that can be more efficient with fertilizers and water? Can we build more resilient crops? Can we use things like alternative proteins and alternative dairies to make things that taste like meat and taste like milk, but are more efficient on our food systems? But I think the sustainable food area is a very important aspect of consumerism, because of that rising consumer, and also because we're seeing a greater preference from consumers to think about sustainability in their food purchases.
And do you see less people in the West actually eating meat and more vegetarians essentially going forward? Is this a trend that's already playing out, I suppose, in it to a certain extent? But do you see it going further?
We are. I mean, we're seeing growth in areas like alternative meats and alternative dairies. You know, plant-based meats are growing. We're seeing an uptick. You know, frankly, a lot of people, if you, you know, if you look at the space, think the food is very comparable. The prices are very comparable. And so we're seeing that greater awareness among millennials of, you know, if it tastes the same, if it costs the same, if it looks and feels the same, but it's much more sustainable, then why would I not go the plant-based approach? To give an example of kind of how impactful this is, you typically only get about 2 calories of meat, especially if you're looking at cattle. You only get about 2 calories of meat for every 100 calories of input, meaning all the calories you feed a cow over its lifetime before it becomes meat, you're only getting 2% efficiency out of it. So if you can reduce your dependence on livestock and go to the source, those crops that you would otherwise be feeding that livestock, you can get much more efficiency out of our food systems.
Mm-hmm. And swinging back to the blockchain, which is obviously such a nascent area at the moment, but obvious that it's going to have some bigger impact going forward. What are the main, we touched on it slightly, but the use cases that you think are going to come to be the things that people use it for in day-to-day life? What are the first things we need to do? Is it just for purchasing goods and services or?
Well, I think there's a transactional use case to it, especially in kind of more complex transactions. So we could see it being used in areas like real estate. We could see it being used as we're seeing with art today. We could see, you know, more tokenization of different assets, kind of breaking up, you know, hard assets and allowing people to invest in them through tokens. I think on the consumer side of things, though, it's really about extending financial services. So if you can use blockchain technology to lower the cost of providing financial services to people, there's billions of people who could use those financial services, whether that's, you know, small loans. It just might not make sense to open a traditional bank account, to go through the loan approval process, all the different aspects that traditional financial systems use, you know, to give someone a small loan. Can you make a microloan with blockchain and crypto more efficiently? I think that's, you know, a really exciting area to explore, especially in emerging markets, and especially using alternative currencies where, you know, in emerging markets, you know, they're not always, you know, currencies aren't always effective forms of storing value.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I can see that happening very, very quickly as long as the UI UX sort of gets improved to a certain level, it's obviously going to then become mainstream. I think the only problem that sort of remains probably is this regulation and taxes issue related to, you know, however these coins are classed, whether they're classed as security or not. What sort of challenges do you think are in the way of these?
Well, I think that's a good point. But, you know, in a lot of ways, the infrastructure has been built. So if we focus on that emerging market consumer and their use of blockchain technology, the key thing that they need is a cell phone. And we have a lot of internet connectivity in the emerging markets already. So with that penetration of internet, you know, the regulations, the, you know, building out the UX, UI, you know, I think all of that's going to come over time. But the key hurdle has already been achieved of people have access to this. They already have access. They have a means of access. So that makes me very optimistic that this theme is going to continue to enjoy, you know, a very strong trajectory going forward.
How do you, at BlackRock, what sort of things do you offer to get exposure to these sort of areas?
Yeah, so, you know, similar to the industrial renaissance, you know, we have specific ETFs that are providing exposure to each of these themes. On the blockchain side, we launched IBLC, our iShares blockchain and tech ETF, which is getting exposure to the entire blockchain ecosystem. So that's, you know, crypto miners, that's crypto exchanges, hardware that goes into crypto mining, you know, blockchain developers building the latest blockchain technologies, really looking at that entire ecosystem, not just trying to focus on a specific coin or a specific corner of the market, but really looking at all the different areas that we think will benefit from the rise of blockchain technology. And then separately through the sustainable food theme, we recently launched an ETF, iVeg, our emergent food and ag tech multi-sector ETF. Which is similarly looking at all these different aspects of the sustainable food ecosystem. So agricultural technologies, including you know, areas like smart farming, hydroponics, as well as looking at areas like kind of alternative foods that consumers are increasingly consuming.
Amazing. So let's move on to the final theme of upshot of post-COVID medicine, which I believe involves genomics and things such as this. Are medical innovations of accelerating due to what we've seen through COVID and the amount of investment that's gone into this area?
We had a huge unlock during COVID-19 that we're only starting to really understand how powerful it is. And that unlock is that mRNA-based vaccines are now broadly accepted across the world. mRNA is a technology that's been around for several decades. It's been worked on, it's been invested in, there's been, you know, drugs that have been attempted to be developed, but there was never enough money behind it that was being invested into mRNA vaccines. From a regulatory perspective, there was hesitance on approving this technology for broader use. And of course, with COVID-19, we found out very quickly that mRNA-based vaccines are really the quickest, most effective way to develop vaccines against this, you know, against this horrible virus. It brought in a ton more money. It brought in that regulatory, movement to accelerate the approval of these drugs. And now the question is, how do we use this technology in other applications? You know, we've created these vaccines for COVID, but can we create vaccines for HIV, for malaria, for the flu? All these different areas where, you know, previously we've had very limited success with traditional based vaccines. So I think this is a transformational moment for healthcare as we look at mRNA technology and seek to apply it in areas beyond COVID-19. And then maybe taking an even further step back, you know, mRNA vaccines are really just one expression of genomics, the study of our individual genetics and how we can modify, edit, change, interact with those genes to limit certain debilitating diseases. Right now, there's lots of clinical trials that are happening in this space, with some really interesting results, particularly in areas where you have single gene mutations. Meaning, if you just changed one gene in your entire body, you wouldn't have, the potential for a horrible disease. If we can edit that, if we can use genomics technology to make those changes, I think we'll see, you know, fantastic advancements in medicine going forward as well. So this is an area, you know, if we're thinking about, you know, kind of silver linings related to COVID-19. The fact that we now have so much more investment and regulatory tailwind behind genomics more broadly, but also mRNA-based vaccines more specifically, I think this is a very exciting area going forward.
Yeah, and it's almost good timing in a way, because obviously people are living longer. Global population, as you mentioned earlier, is growing fast. It's going to be above 1 billion by 2030, and by 2050, a third of the population of 55 countries will be over 60 years old. Demand on healthcare is obviously going to be huge. So what sort of areas outside of these are going to need sort of some innovations coming to? I imagine people might need more money to retire, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is going to challenge our society in a lot of ways. You know, one of the things you can look at is the dependency ratio, which is, you know, how many people do you have supporting, you know, the seniors and young children in our society? And you can imagine, as society gets older, you have, you know, a worsening ratio of, you know, kind of able-bodied workers producing things, supporting a population that needs support from people. We have aging populations in Asia. We have it in Europe. We're seeing it in the U.S. as well. And it's going to really strain huge parts of our economy. You know, the most obvious, I think, is healthcare. You know, how do we provide the nursing support for people with advanced age-related diseases? How do we build enough medical devices to support them? How do we, you know, continue to develop drugs to treat advanced age-related diseases like Alzheimer's or cancers or Parkinson's? So healthcare, I think, is a very direct line as participating in that trend of aging populations. But you're absolutely right. There's economic impacts as well on consumerism. You know, I think we should be focused on, you know, where are seniors spending their money, because the baby boomers are a very wealthy generation in the United States that are going to be spending their money in unique ways as well, different from millennials for sure. And it'll impact investments. You know, if you're spending more years in retirement, which is wonderful because lifespans are increasing and people have, you know, managed their money, you know, over the course of their lifetime. You know, what does that mean? If you're depending on 30 years of retirement, you need to save more money. Maybe you need more growth in the early stages of your retirement. You can't simply just depend on fixed income for meeting your needs for 30 years. So there's really complex questions, across you know, healthcare consumption and investing for sure.
And in terms of the gene and cell therapy, which inhibits these disease-causing genes, how far away are we from that actually being something people can, you know, use in real life? Or are we there yet? I'm not on top of it as much as you.
Well, we're making a lot of progress. And, you know, frankly, one of the challenges is, you know, just these things take time. We have to go through trials, and trials have to see, you know, clinical successes. You have to see regulatory approvals. There has to be, you know, significant funding. All of these things have to come together. But the reality is we've seen huge advancements in this technology. One of the reasons why is because it's gotten a lot cheaper to collect genetic data. So if you go back to when the first human genome was sequenced, it cost billions of dollars, and it took well over a decade to sequence all of that data. Now, fast forward to today, it's a few hundred dollars and maybe a few hours of work to be able to sequence an individual's genes now. With that cost decline and with that time decline, it means more and more people's genetics are being captured and analyzed. And that becomes very helpful because the bigger library of people you have and understanding what their genetics look like and then what that expresses itself as down the road with, you know, diseases or immunities or what have you, then you can start to develop more treatments. So you need this kind of growing pool of data to be able to generate insights from that data and develop, you know, medical treatments. And we're seeing that pool grow bigger and bigger each year as more people get their genetics tested. And we see more, you know, information coming out of all of that research. So we're starting to see some really promising trials. You know, it's difficult not to get too excited about this because I think everyone wants the same outcome here, which is for these trials to be successful and for, you know, genetic medicine to grow. But it's we're still very much in kind of the testing phase for a lot of these new technologies.
So soon everyone's going to be sending, mapping their genome. Everyone will be doing it because it's so cheap. So everyone's going to know exactly what is sort of wrong with them or might be wrong with them in the future, and they can sort of take action to prevent it. Is that sort of the future we're going to be at soon?
Exactly. Well, you know, think of when you go to the doctor today, you know, they ask you all these questions, which is trying to basically play probabilities to guess what might be wrong with you. So gender, age, occupation, family history, all of that is just trying to, you know, make some sort of picture of, okay, you know, in, you know, you're likely because your father had heart disease, and maybe you, you know, you're in a group that's more likely to have heart disease to now have heart disease. But that's not really answering a very specific question. If you can look at someone's genetics and see that they actually have a marker which is linked to heart disease, then you have a lot more certainty than just these very broad brushstrokes questions. So, you know, collecting all this data can get more and more personalized medicine. And then beyond that, it's not just detecting whether you may or may not have heart disease. It's what is the right treatment for you. So if a pharmaceutical company has thousands of medical records and the genetic data behind it of understanding when we gave this person this medicine and they responded this way, we should give someone else with a similar genetic composition the same medicine. They can start to get a lot better at really fine-tuning the treatments for individuals as well. So, you know, it's really a step function in advancements in not only understanding people at a genetic level, but also treating them at that genetic level for more effective treatments.
And what sort of products do you have that track this theme?
So we have iDNA, the iShares Genomics Immunology and Healthcare ETF, which is really looking at companies, again, across the entire ecosystem of genomics and immunology innovation. So it's looking globally at all the different companies that are really leading in some of these genetic trials, genetic technologies, and trying to capture that full ecosystem. The reality is, you know, these trials in a lot of ways are difficult to predict. We don't know if they'll be successful or not. And the idea behind capturing the entire ecosystem of these genetics companies is, you know, really trying to diversify our bets across these different companies and hopefully capture some of those winners when we do see these trials succeed.
Yeah, a very important strategy in those sort of areas. Otherwise, all your eggs in one basket can be very, very bad, really. So moving on to, so you talked about a lot of ETFs here. I believe you've got a mixture of active managed ones and sort of index sort of based ones. What are the benefits of each, and how should people choose these when, you know, sort of combining them together in their portfolio?
It's a great question. And, you know, this is a really unique part of BlackRock is that we have both our index-based approach to thematic investing and we have active portfolio managers that are, you know, picking individual stocks within each of these themes. So, you know, there's different use cases for both. I think some investors maybe just want to capture the entire ecosystem of a theme. If you're interested in robotics broadly and want to get exposure to robotics and AI, and be able to plug that into a portfolio with that whole ecosystem approach, I think the index-based approach can be very helpful. But if an investor says, you know, I don't know which technology I want, I don't know if I want robotics or if I want something else, I just want a portfolio manager to make those decisions for me, picking the themes and picking the individual companies within those themes, then the active-based approach can work too. So there's benefits to both. And I'm very excited that we have an offering for both because, you know, no investor is going to be the same and people are going to value different approaches depending on how they manage their portfolios.
Yeah. And how for those individuals that do find it hard to sort of narrow it down to one theme, even between sort of different active ETFs, is there sort of an approach that you think would help people? Obviously, some people know just straight up they like certain themes, but what would you suggest in terms of helping them narrow down the ecosystem?
Yeah. So first of all, I would say, you know, don't just pick one theme. I would diversify, you know, for the typical investor, you know, diversify across three or four themes and look for themes that are going to behave very differently from each other. You know, a genomics theme is not going to look a lot like a robotics theme. They have very different companies. One's more healthcare oriented, another one's more industrials and tech oriented. You know, one's more US based, the other one's more global. So if you can combine a few themes that are really targeting different areas of the economy and diversify across a few different themes that way, I think that can be a very good positive approach to portfolio management. But the other thing to look at, if you're really not just looking at diversification, but also thinking about the growth opportunity, I would say is look at how big is the total market that this is addressing? You know, the bigger the market, the bigger the growth potential of the theme. And where are we in that process of adoption? Is this already a pretty mature theme? Are we already seeing, you know, this technology has been adopted broadly, or the theme has been adopted broadly, or is it still very early days? If it's early days and it's a big total addressable market, in some ways, that means there can be more risk to the theme because there's a long way to go and anything could happen. But it also means there could be more growth potential because we still have a long runway before we see a theme fully play out. So I would absolutely, you know, have investors think about it from that framework. How big is it and where are we today when thinking about some of the growth opportunity with a thematic ETF?
Well, thanks, Jay. That's been really interesting. And it's great to see how you're helping BlackRock sort of expand their thematic universe so comprehensively. Yeah, really interesting insights in each of these big themes that are so relevant to today. Where can people go to find more insights from yourself and look into more detail on these themes at BlackRock? I believe you've also got a white paper that we mentioned early on that they can get more information on as well.
Yes, I would suggest, you know, anyone listening who's interested in more research and more information about these funds to visit iShares.com/megatrends. We have that great acceleration paper there. We have videos. We have more information about the funds. But that's really our central location for all things thematic at BlackRock.
Thanks, Jay. And just before we sign off, have you got some sort of a book or a website or something you follow quite closely that gives you sort of insights that are relevant to this that people might be interested in?
You know, that's a great question. You know, where I found a lot of success in following these themes is on Twitter and really kind of curating the following, because each of these themes is totally different. You know, the robotics ecosystem has all these different publications and books and authors and experts that are totally different from everything in the genomic space or the infrastructure space. So I think investors should, you know, seek that out on their own. But also, I think Twitter is a great way to just curate these experts and keep a pulse on what's happening in all these themes. I mean, people can follow me on Twitter at jjacobcfa and look at who I'm following for some suggestions, because there's plenty of great academics, futurists, investors, technologists that I'm following that have been really helpful in keeping up to date with all these technologies.
Well, cheers, Jay. That's brilliant. And yeah, good luck with everything at BlackRock.
Thanks, Ed. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Just a quick note before we sign off. If you're looking for an easily digestible daily update on the markets, this might be of interest. Opto Updates is our short newsletter sent every day during the trading week, giving you a bulleted list of the top 7 stories from the global stock markets. We've done the hard work for you, highlighting relevant opportunities and trends. And in addition, we'll also keep you notified of any new products, stock reports, or webinars from the Opto world. If you're interested, sign up using the link in the show notes. And thanks also to CoFruition for consulting on and producing the show. Until next time.
CoFruition.